Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Batman Family Reunion, proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Sean M. Myers, M for Man-Bat, one of your hosts, and with me as always is my co-host and Bat-cousin, Paul Keene. How are you this month, Paul?
Hey, Sean, I'm great, but I'm looking for Bat-Uncle Jack. He always tells me that I'm his number one guy. How about you?
I was hanging out with Bat Cousin George while he was sipping his Bat Nespresso. We want to welcome Ward Hill Terry back to the reunion. Terry, it has been a while. How are you? But more importantly, what did you bring to eat?
I'm feeling bat-tastic, my friends and my cousins. I brought something that was a big hit at our Thanksgiving table, some homemade trifle with homemade chocolate cake, homemade chocolate pudding, and homemade whipped cream, all layered together in a big, beautiful glass bowl.
Oh, man. And what'd you bring for everybody else, if that's for me?
Does it include any meat?
It does not.
That's for my friends.
There might be some rennet in the pudding.
We do want to let all of our Bat cousins know that there are still a handful of openings left to be a guest. Remaining issues are 490, 491, and 494. If you have any interest in being on one of those episodes, please let one of us know.
And if you enjoy my appearance here, if no one else stepped up to the plate, I'm going to be the temporary permanent guest host for those issues.
So please, volunteer.
So consider that a threat, Bat Cousins.
Oh, why don't you remind our listeners what our show is all about?
All right, Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978 and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing on as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even the Demon. Both of your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out, and they are excited to share their love of this era at the Batman Family Reunion. So before we get started, Terry and Sean, I wanted to say thanks to our guest from last episode, Brett Young, who created a cool t-shirt design for Batman Family Reunion. It's on his TeePublic store, and I will include a link to it in the show notes. Don't forget there are other show designs from other hosts on the network that you can access from the merch section on fireandwaterpodcast.com. But, of course, we're a little partial to Batman Family Reunion t-shirt, I have to say.
The design looks so cool.
The design is awesome.
I'm so happy with it. I had nothing to do with it.
I couldn't do it. We couldn't do it. That's why my Brett did it. So now let's get into Detective 485, starring the Batman family.
It is cover dated August-September from 1979. The release date was May 10th, 1979. 64 pages with no ads, cover price, of course, $1. The number of stories is 5, and the cover artist is Dick Giordano. And the cover, of course, has the trade dress dollar comic banner on top with the Batman starring in Detective Comics logo with his cape enveloping that logo. It's one of the boxed covers. So in the box, there's Batman acting like a Rockette, kicking Scalp Hunter in the face. With a solid purple background, and on the left is a bunch of text in red and then blue and then black and then red. Whose death causes Batman to swear the vengeance vow? And then a logo, plus Batgirl, Robin, and Man-Bat in their own full-length features, and then a logo, and a bonus story, The Demon's Last Battle, and then the barcode. What do you guys think? How about you, Terry?
Oh, it's all right. It's funny, though, until I actually looked carefully at the signature at the bottom of the cover, I just thought this was a Ross Andrew cover.
Yeah.
Dick has drawn Batman and the Bronze Tiger with what I think of as distinctive Ross Andrew kind of knees and elbows and contorted figures.
Mm-hmm.
Closer examination, these are Dick Giordano faces. Yeah, it's pretty. It's all right. Nothing great.
I like the red in the logo. We talked a lot about the logo. We got a lot of comments already about our discussion of the logo. As I said last time, I don't hate it. I don't think it's the best one, but we have a number of people already, so they like it. I like the red, though. It pops out to me. I never liked the white borders on the outside of the covers, but I do like the red inside the cape there. I think that's pretty sharp.
It does seem to give the cape a little more volume inside.
Yeah, that's right. That's what kind of what I feel like. I also would have mistaken this for Ross Andrew, but I think Sensei gives it away that it's Giordano.
This is the last issue with no ads.
Yeah, thank goodness.
You want something to talk about, right?
I understand that theoretically, technically, ads aren't great. And of course, when I'm streaming something, I try to skip over them. And but I love the ad. I love the comic.
You
want to
talk about those Twinkies pages again?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. It is funny because for such a dynamic cover, Batman kicking and bronze tigers. I don't know. I don't know if it's that just all that one color background.
That's it. That purple background is kind of
rich, I think, but Batman should have been fighting Bronze Tiger. That would have made for a better cover.
Yeah.
Sensei just has his hands in his sleeves, and it makes me think of a Christmas caroler with her hands in her muff. Like he's just like singing over there and it's really cold.
But how about, let's talk about the back cover, guys.
The back cover is fantastic. You have full figure Batgirl and Robin. Batgirl's hanging by her bat line. Robin is braced up against a building, and it's at night with a deep orange moon behind them. Best bat wishes, Batgirl and Robin. You know how when you're in a relationship and you send a Christmas card or a birthday card and one person signs it? This is the same thing, because both Batgirl and Robin, that handwriting is the same. I don't know who it is, but one person signed this card for the both of them.
I love everything about this. The only thing isn't the greatest is Robin's face is slightly off. Not as young as Kurt Schaffenberger looking, but Babs is showing off her core strength. Dick is climbing up the wall. Good stuff.
That calf muscle of Dick is fantastic.
Yeah.
And looking at it now, after having read so many years and years of comics critique and criticism about the medium, it just disappointing that the building that Robin is braced against and the background water tower and billboard, everything is straight up and down. There's no dynamic tilt of the background. Those Carmine Infantino spot illustrations, I mean, the verticals would still be straight up and down, but everything else be sort of askew to give you a sense of the depth. The figures are gorgeous, but it also made me miss the Batgirl Robin team. It made me realize, wow, it's been several issues since that was a thing.
And I think my Bat cousins could definitely correct me if I'm wrong. We only have one more, right, in the whole run?
We get a Batgirl and Batman.
Right. But I think we have one more Batgirl and Robin.
I think you're right.
Dynamite duo.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we will post the image of both of these covers, the front and the back, as well as plenty of additional pages from each of the stories in our family portrait gallery on the network's website. Sean, could you remind everybody where that is?
Of course I can, because I have it committed to memory. I'm not reading off of a page. http://.../FireAndWaterPodcast.com Now, let's jump into the first story.
Well, our first story is one that I'm sure will engender a lot of conversation. It is called The Vengeance Vow, as indicated on the cover. Batman versus the Bronze Tiger, featuring Kathy Kane. It's a 20-pager by Denny O'Neill with beautiful art again by Don Newton and Dan Adkins, has been reprinted twice in the Tales of the Batman Don Newton hardcover and Batman Tales of the Demon hardcover, which has all these Denny O'Neill League of Assassins stories. So let's get into The Vengeance Vow. An anonymous tip that the League of Assassins is at Kathy Kane's circus brings Batman to investigate. He steps in time to help Kathy knock out some thugs, but frankly, she was doing pretty well on her own. But after those thugs are disposed of, Kathy and Batman turn around and face the Bronze Tiger. Batman engages him, but the tiger surprises him with a fancy martial arts kick to the stomach, and Batman blacks out as he sees a knife coming down toward Kathy. When he wakes, he follows a trail of blood and finds Kathy dead, holding her Batwoman costume. At that minute, Ra's al Ghul appears, and Batman accuses him of being responsible for Kathy's murder. But no, Ra's says he was the one who sent the anonymous tip. In fact, it is Sensei and the League of Assassins who ordered her death. But why? She was not a threat to them. Ra's suggests maybe someone told them that she was. He tries to give Batman a map to their location, but Bruce won't accept his help. He still thinks Ra's is not telling him the whole story. In fact, he's right. After the Dark Knight detective leaves, Talia emerges from the shadows, asking her father why he is manipulating her beloved. We find out that Ra's wants control of the League of Assassins, but can't get rid of the Sensei while he has the Bronze Tiger in his thrall. We cut to the Sensei overseeing a training session where the Tiger makes quick work of four armed men. But when ordered by the Sensei to kill them, the tiger, quote, respectfully refuses and walks away. A little monologuing by the sensei, and we figure out that he has been completely brainwashed, the tiger, who no longer remembers his life as Ben Turner, martial artist and partner to Richard Dragon, kung fu fighter. His aversion to killing still remains, but the sensei figures he will wipe that out soon, and then the tiger will be completely his. Just then, a guard realizes someone is approaching their hideout. So sensei says, release the Kraken, the snarling Dobermans. The intruder is, of course, Batman. So for the second time in as many months, the Caped Crusader has to fight foes of the canine variety. Fortunately, these dogs are just knocked out, and Batman continues through the gauntlet. Next, the sensei sends one of the thugs, who he asserts was Ra's spy, to face Batman. He doesn't last long, and Batman greets the sensei. He asserts that he is taking the tiger and the others who were responsible for Kathy's death to face justice. Sensei compliments him and says he sees why Ra's admires Batman so much. Batman faces the tiger, and sensei orders everyone else not to interfere. Even assassins have honor, you know. This gives Don Newton the chance to show his chops with some amazing martial arts moves. Batman is holding his own against the tiger this time when Ra's spy wakes up and realizes if he doesn't do something, the sensei will kill him. So he grabs a handy blowgun and poison dart and shoots Batman. Sensei is pissed and immediately kills the thug, but when he tells his other followers to kill Batman, the tiger objects. Sensei can't have that, so he orders his guys to take them both out. Batman struggles to turn out the lights, but when they come back on, everyone is gone except the two thugs who were with the tiger when Kathy was killed. Batman finds the tiger's mask, thinking, maybe this means that Kathy's been avenged, but maybe not. To be continued throughout the Batman titles, look for The War of the Assassins. Woo! Had a lot going on there, fellas. What did you think of The Vengeance Vow? Terry, let's start with you.
Even after all these years, it is still a very disappointing story. First of all, it's gorgeous. It is absolutely gorgeous. When I was looking through all the issues to get back on the podcast, there are so many stories that are stuck in my head. There are panels that are stuck in my head. There are word balloons that are stuck in my head, one of which comes in later in this issue. But this story, I remembered how beautiful it looked, how cool the bronze tiger looks as drawn by Don Newton. I think this is the reason that the bronze tiger eventually became something that other characters picked up on, it because he just looks the tiger mask.
Yeah, he's super cool in this story. It is, no question about it.
It's just fantastic. Clearly, Don Newton was working on what a tiger skull actually looks like. He did a similar job with Taki Tawny in the Captain Marvel strip, the Shazam strip, in World's Finest. He made Taki Tawny look like a tiger. Semi-realistic, but not cartoony, and threaded the needle beautifully. But this mask looks like a tiger head, and it looks like a mask. He's not making any expressions. And his body in that sort of orangey, tigery uniform is magnificent. But the whole story, even back then, I started to get annoyed with Denny O'Neill's Batman stories in the late 70s. Denny O'Neill has a great reputation because he did a lot of very good stories. He did some of the best, but he also did some of the most mediocre ones, I think.
Like the Galileo solution?
Yeah, really, yeah.
But similar to the Galileo solution, it's set up out of nothing, and things happen because they have to happen in the overall sense of the story. What Batman is trying to do is rather unclear, and at the climactic fight at the end of the story, he does it very gentlemanly style. He and the Bronze Tiger square off. Why? So we can see a good action sequence in the comics, like, you know, a Hong Kong movie or something like that. But why doesn't Batman use a smoke bomb or tear gas? He has devices in his utility belt. Why is he being so honorable all of a sudden? His job is to get the people who assassinated his friend. But he doesn't, because the story doesn't call for it.
I think Denny was in a big martial arts phase, right?
This is a kung fu story.
Yeah, this is the first appearance of Bronze Tiger since the end of Richard Dragon. Yeah. And Bronze Tiger only has one more pre-crisis appearance, and that's in a couple issues here. I think he had more planned, but a year plus from now, then he jumps ship and goes to Marvel to be an editor. So I don't know if we saw everything that he originally had planned.
This seems so disconnected from the Batman that was appearing in Batman comics. I was looking at the covers, what was happening at that point. This is just about when Len Wein is starting, or just before Len Wein's starting, and Len starts building a world for Batman with side characters and secondary and tertiary characters and a life of Bruce Wayne, which Jerry Conway just runs with. This story could happen anytime in Batman's career. after he's first met Ra's al Ghul. Another character I got quickly bored with. Danny was doing all these same tropes. It was the League of Assassins and Maxi Zeus and Ra's al Ghul. These stories were never referred to in other Batman stories. They weren't consequential. It was just the same thing over and over again. But the thing that really annoyed me and still annoys me is Kathy Kane's murder. Kathy Kane had been out of comics for the longest time until Batman Family brought her back. Bob Rozakis brought her back. Okay, we haven't seen her for a while, but she's brought in just to be killed. Just to be killed. Batman gets a tip that the League of Assassins is there. Does he call up the circus? Does he call up the police in wherever they are and says, be careful, there's a bunch of guys trying to kill you? These guys walk into Kathy's tent. She doesn't call, hey, Rube. I mean, I've read a lot of DC comics that they're every fifth one set in a circus. They call, hey, Rube. And the whole circus, people come running to save you. Her dialogue does not sound like the Kathy Kane we've seen in other things. It's merely terrific to see you. Man, I always hated that.
Yeah,
that's one of those word balloons that stuck with me for the wrong reason. She's shown being highly competent, looking great, holding her own, but she's all by herself. There's no one else around. It's just she becomes a MacGuffin. Just get this thing in motion. And then she is disappeared. She is not mourned. She is not given any sort of tribute, either in the story or in the editorial, nothing. She could just be another random victim of a homicide to get a story going. And that's really annoying because Bob Rozakis had made this cartoonish character from the 1950s into a real character. And where the heck are the freedom fighters? They're working on this in this circus. In my Bob Rozakis world. Human Bomb going to take care of this League of Assassins.
I think the Bob Rozakis world has gotten eaten up by the crisis cloud a few years early. Listen, I agree with you about the plot points. I mean, Denny O'Neill has written some of my favorite Batman stories, but some of the ones have been silly, like the kangaroo one, or nonsensical, like the other one. But you're right about this one. It's just things happen because things have to happen. Hey, I'm all good to see Don Newton with a great martial arts fight with Batman and the Bronze Tiger, but it did seem a little artificial. So now let me ask you guys a question. I always had thought before rereading this recently that Bronze Tiger had actually killed Kathy. My head canon was always that when he joined the Suicide Squad, he was atoning for that death, even though Suicide Squad is post-crisis and all that stuff. But in my head, he joined the Suicide Squad. He didn't have to. He wasn't a criminal. He didn't have a bomb in his neck like everybody else. But I don't think they ever mentioned Kathy in Suicide Squad because it was post-crisis. But it looks to me like he didn't actively kill her like one of those other two guys did. But he did stand aside and let the others do it. But then he doesn't let the others kill Batman. So I'm struggling with the logic there. It feels like Denny was trying to show how great a fighter he is because one of Denny's creation in Richard Dragon. And Denny does that like he did with Maxi Zeus. He's trying to build him up. He wants to make him a bad guy, but he doesn't want to completely make him a bad guy because maybe he wants him to be a good guy later kind of thing. That was the part that was plot-wise muddled to me. How about you, Sean?
So we'll start off with the things I like. And there are some things I like. I actually love Ra's al Ghul, especially at this time.
Yeah, I like Ra's al Ghul better than you do too, Terry.
I was introduced to Ra's in the Treasury.
Yeah, me too.
I didn't know that they were reprints. I thought this was like an all brand new special story, the Treasury, because they're killing Robin. That's how special it was. The martial arts aspect of this, which carries over from that. So I really like that. Bronze Tiger, I think, looks fantastic. And even like nowadays, like if you watch the DC animated movie, Soul of the Dragon, that's fantastic. Yeah. And I love that.
That was awesome, wasn't it?
That was fantastic. I love that character. That's fantastic. Sensei by Don Newton. Oh my God, he just looks fantastic. I actually do like that thug realizes that he's going to get punished by letting Batman survive. So then he tries to kill Batman.
And then he kills
Batman.
Anyway.
Sensei kills him. I do. That sounds horrible, but I do like that. You know,
yeah,
like
I do.
He's the only character in the whole story whose motivation is clear.
Yeah. Like, Paul, I think that the Dobermans were knocked out.
That's right. They're stunned.
I don't know that that's true, but that's what I'm thinking.
There you go, being speciesist again.
Yeah, I know.
Only time I was ever bitten by a dog was Doberman pinchers. I have no love for Dobermans, but yeah, they're just stunned.
Obviously, yes, I absolutely hate that they killed Kathy Kane in this way. I'm not even saying that a hero has to go out saving a town or saving a child from a bomb or anything. So Bat Cousins, once again, I'm going to ask you to do my homework for me, because I know there's some kind of panel where Batman is talking about how theoretically it's something like, you know, I could be taken out by Joker or Two-Face in a grand plan, or I could just die because some thug gets lucky shooting a gun or something like that. Even if a hero is shot down accidentally because a gun went off, theoretically kind of fine with that. I'm not saying that there needs to be, oh, what's that most famous, whatever happened to, is it Crimson Avenger?
Crimson Avenger.
Yeah.
On the boat.
So that is a great story, but I am not saying that every hero has to go out like that. Sometimes, you know, no. It can be just, but just this is just dumb and horrible. Yeah. And maybe I'm wrong. It feels like he came up with the title, The Vengeance Vow.
Yeah.
Oh, well, who can we kill who that there's going to be this vengeance? Now, to get back to what I love, because I want to talk about something.
Okay.
Yeah. I love that Kathy is like kicking everybody and taking care of herself. And
yes.
She didn't really need Batman. I love, absolutely love that part of it.
I do too. The thing about the vengeance also, when this book came out in 1979, I was a freshman in high school. And I'd just been reading comics about 3 years. And just the year earlier, 2 years earlier, was the Aquaman series where Aqua Baby was killed.
Mm. Yeah.
But the upshot of that was at the end of that prolonged story, when Aqua Baby was definitively dead, Mira gets mad at Aquaman for running off on some foolish macho vengeance thing instead of staying there with her. And this is a similar thing. It's a vengeance. I'm not going to call her next of kin. I'm not going to call Dick and say, we have to set up a funeral arrangement. Nothing, not even a mention of that.
Yeah.
There's no humanity. And that's, especially now, that I'm an older person, I think about these things a lot.
Yeah. One thing quick that I do want to, because I do want to talk about things that I like.
Yes,
in
absolutely.
This story. On page 16, when you see the thug, the bruise on his head.
Oh, I love that.
God. The one when Batman hit him with his own nunchaku.
That hurt. I like looking yes. at it. It makes me
oh,
hurt.
Man.
The other one, my favorite line was the fact that Batman memorizes every license plate. Yeah.
Yes. The only car.
Ra's al Ghul wouldn't make that mistake, Sensei.
I have trouble remembering my license plate number.
So, yeah, we don't like what happens in the story. We don't love the construction and motivations of the story for sure, but it's beautiful to look at. The action scenes are great. There's some touches in here.
And Sean, that thug with the blow dart, someone else who shops the Don Newton School of Pattern Pants for you there.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, he does. Yeah.
I like the League of Assassins, the Society of Shadows. I like that as an idea, as an organization. I guess technically I can't say that I hate this story. Like, I definitely hate what happens and it's just so dumb. But
right. That's where I land too.
And Tiger gets a knife in the back and he's not dead.
Yeah, but he's a cool character. I don't want him to be.
And by the way, Bat listeners, if you've never read the Richard Dragon Kung Fu Fighter stories, they are all on DC Universe. And I want to say a year or two ago, they came out with a nice collection of the entire series, a hardcover collection that I did pick up. It's a fun read. I mean, it's like you said, Terry, it's a Kung Fu type style stuff. They're trying to capitalize on it. It's not as good as Master of Kung Fu, of course. I enjoyed reading it. You know, your mileage may differ.
Now, we want to move on to the Bat timeline. In this segment, we're going to take a look at the other titles that were published this month. But before we do, we want to acknowledge the passing of Mike Violes, V-I-O-L-E-S, who created Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics. We absolutely could not do this segment or probably the show without the creation of his website. And we both, Paul and I, have spent countless hours just clicking and reminiscing while perusing the website. It's hard for me to believe, if you're listening to us, that you have never gone to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. If you have never gone, go to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. It is phenomenal.
Go there now and we'll see you in a few days.
Yeah, absolutely. We use the newsstand feature, which shows every book that was on display. You can do like a series gallery at work. I'll pull up the Best of DC Digest and look and count how many Supermans were there, how many Batman. Yeah, you will lose yourself for hours. It is phenomenal. I am so happy and glad that it is going on. We really appreciate it. And we're going to use that right now to look at the books that we are going to pick off of the newsstand for this month, which is May of 1979. And as always, we are going to start with the Bat books this month.
Batman 314 is our first one, and that is Batman versus Two-Face with a fabulous Jose Luis Garcia Lopez,
praise be his name,
cover of Batman hanging off the helicopter and Two-Face flipping his coin to see whether he's going to kick him off the helicopter or not. And this, as you mentioned, Terry, is great Len Wein, Irv Novick, guest starring King Faraday, apparently.
And Bat Cousins, I'm going to tell you something. I know that Cousin Paul likes me. That's evident. That's obvious. But never more so have I felt that love than in our script when it says Batman 314, Sean versus Two-Face. Because apparently, apparently he thinks so highly of me that he gets me mixed up. Batmite, yeah, that I get. I could completely understand that. Yes. Dazzler? Yeah, because she's a fantastic singer. But Batman? Wow. He confused us in the script, so...
Hey, you know, it's okay when you find typos in the comic book, Sean.
The next one we're going to talk about is The Brave and the Bold, and it is Sean teaming up with Red Tornado in the menace of the Murder Machines. Holy moly.
So next up are two unexpected entries. One is DC Special Series number 17, starring the Swamp Thing. What? Well, the reason that's in here is the classic Night of the Bat by Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson is reprinted in this. I had this issue, one of the very, very few Swamp Things I had when I was a kid. I presume since I noticed Batman was in one of the stories. And then Batman is also in Flash number 276. Batman and the entire Justice League are guest stars in this story that is entitled Freak Out. Flash is attacking them on the JLA satellite. Why? Well, unfortunately, in the off month for us, in Flash 275, Iris Allen, Flash's wife, was murdered by the Reverse Flash, and he is, well, freaking out. You know, this could also be the reason why Kathy Kane's death went fairly unnoticed, since Iris was a bigger profile death.
And the cover is fantastic because Flash is hitting, he's not kicking Green Lantern, but he's coming at Green Lantern with his yellow boots, like in the face.
Yeah.
And once again, my Bat Cousins, I'm calling on you for help because I can't do this research, or I'm too lazy, or I can't figure it out. I know that there's a story, I think it's probably a Justice League story, where Green Lantern creates, you know, like a travel bubble that he does so they can fly through space. And there is a specific panel where Flash has his boots in his hand because he wouldn't be able to stand on, you know, like the green travel bubble. And I want to find out what issue that is, because I want to look back from that issue to see if he's ever standing on a Green Lantern platform or something.
He has. I can think of a couple of ones where Flash just standing there inside the green construct. I want to see his feet come right through.
Yeah, I know. Like just stuck halfway. And then once it gets to the red of his outfit, it grabs hold of him.
Exactly.
Our next book is JLA number 169. And of course, Batman stars in that. It is The Doomsday Decision. And it is a fantastic cover because it's Superman and Batman being attacked by a horde of people. And Batman is saying, people attacking us for no reason, as if some evil presence has taken over their minds. And then this villain, can't even describe him. It's like he's kind of like in pieces, bald and shriveled. And Rob, it guest stars Ultra.
Not that one.
Ultra the multi-eye. The next one, of course, is Super Friends number 23, SOS from Nowhere. And it is a fantastic cover. Mirror Master is the villain. It takes place in a hall of mirror, and you see the back of Xan and Jaina. And it says, the Super Friends are trapped in a mirror world. How can we save them? And then Wonder Woman is saying, the Wonder Twins are in deadly danger. Somehow we must rescue them. Rob talked about that on For All Mankind, so go listen to it because it's great.
And the last Bat book this month was World's Finest, number 258. Outstanding Neil Adams cover. You've got Batman, who looks more like Man-Bat, sort of clamping down and attacking Superman. You know, that's going to get me to buy that dollar comic, no question about it. And in this dollar comic, we also get Black Lightning, Green Arrow, Hawkman, and Shazam. So, Terry, what was on your list?
I went through, I bought 21 comics in May of 1979. I was still delivering the Boston Globe every morning, so I had paper route money. Action, Amazing Spider-Man, Avengers, Batman, Brave and the Bold, DC Comics Presents, DC Special with the Swamp Thing, Detective Comics, Fantastic Four, Flash, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Iron Man, Justice League of America, Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, Spider-Woman, Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, Superman, Wonder Woman, World of Krypton, World's Finest, and X-Men. And the thing I want to point out, that issue of Iron Man, I remember I had been looking at Iron Man covers for several months, those great Bob Layton covers. Yeah. And I finally pulled the trigger with this issue because not only did they have this cool picture of Tony Stark, International Man of Mystery, but also the inset of the new Ant-Man. And that, I gotta read this.
And that cover's neat because there's an Iron Man poster on the building. That's great. That looks great. I just pulled that up on Mike's Amazing World of Comics just so I could look at it.
And, you know, I think that World's Finest, that might be the last Neil Adams cover he did for DC at that time. Until, you know, many years later with the reprint stuff.
So, Sean, while I check that out, why don't you go through your list?
So we have Action Comics number 498 with the Catastrophe Man. And it's fantastic because it has Superman flying up, almost either looks like a red sun or red blob of jello. And Superman is flying up and Lana is saying, oh, here comes Superman. He's going to save the day. And Clark Kent says, well, I know that's not Superman because I'm Superman. And I always love those conundrum covers. My next one is Buck Rogers, Giant Movie Edition number 1.
Ooh.
From Gold Key. But I loved the Buck Rogers TV show. Now, when this says Buck Rogers Giant Movie Edition, so Rob, I'm calling on you. Is it just because it's a thick book with lots of pages? Or was it really treasury sized? It's $1.50. So I don't know. My next one, of course, was The Flash. My next one is Marvel Treasury Edition featuring the sensational Spider-Man number 22. And I love this because it's team-ups. So it's Spider-Man teaming up with Captain America, Black Panther, Kazar, and Doctor Strange. That's a great cover. And of course, every month I talk about Spider-Woman, and this time I'm talking about Spider-Woman. And generally, I just talk about Spider-Woman. But I will say, this cover is fantastic. Go to Mike's Amazing World, Spider-Woman number 17. She's falling. I actually don't know what she's falling from, but like there's water in the background. There's a dock that's collapsing, and Spider-Woman is coming like right at us. And then a woman is jumping in after, which it actually looks like Jessica Drew is jumping in after Spider-Woman.
Like you, Sean, I was reading Spider-Woman every month and don't remember any of those stories.
No, I didn't get it every month. That's why I won a collected edition. The next one I actually did have right off of the stand, and that's Superman number 338.
This is
fantastic.
Is this the story where they enlarged Kandor?
Yep.
Yeah. For once, the cover is not lying. Now, it's not represented exactly like this, but Supergirl is lunging at Superman. Superman has a ray gun and he's shattering the Bottle City, although the Bottle City is actually larger than he is. So either it is in the process of enlarging or they're teeny tiny. But I actually remember this, so I won't spoil it, but Kandor doesn't make out too well at the end. Now, my last one that I'm going to talk about is What If? Number 16, What If Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu, fought on the side of Fu Manchu? And I do have this issue. I did not buy it at the time. The only reason why I have this particular single issue is because if you buy the What If, the Complete Collection, Volume 2, they need to cross off this Complete Collection. Because right on the back it says, collecting What If 13 through 15, and 17 through 23. Well, 16's not in it, I guess, because of the Fu Manchu rights.
It took them a long time, those rights, and then they only had them for a little while because Fu Manchu and the other Sax Rohmer characters. Are not owned by Marvel, and that's why Deadly Hands of Kung Fu was never reprinted. I bought the omnibuses, and man, they were great. I had never read that when I was a kid. I had that What If. The What If is in the omnibus, so that's how I have it.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So I have these, the complete collections are the ones with the white.
And then you stick that in the page in between.
So I don't stick it in the page because it'll mess up the spine. But on the shelf, I do have it between volumes 2 and volumes 3. I do have that right between. I don't have it in my comic boxes. I have it on my shelf.
This is why we comic fans really understand Batman's collection mentality in that cave.
With the cave. Yeah.
I gotta have the penny. I gotta have the dinosaur. I gotta get this thing.
What's on your pull list that we haven't already talked about, Paul?
Terry talked about Spider-Man. That's number 195. And the Black Cat debuted in the prior issue in the off month for us. Marv Wolfman, Keith Pollard with story and art. It's on the road to that 200 where Spider-Man faces the burglar who killed Uncle Ben. And then Avengers, the thing that I love about this is fantastic burn cover. You got Scarlet Witch being held by these mystic bolts and the fantastic heads of the Avengers coming down the side.
It's a throwback box cover.
I love that. I'm sorry, Sean, but that is a box cover that sings.
I like that. Yeah. I like the heads on the side. Yeah.
Of note, Marvel Tales number 106 does reprint Spider-Man 129, which is the first appearance of the Punisher for the kids who didn't buy it then. I can't not talk about Marvel 2 and 154. That's part of the Project Pegasus storyline. You got a cover by George Perez and the insides by John Byrne. Perez took over the insides later. Just that is a great, great storyline. My off the beaten path pick this month is Ripley's Believe It or Not number 89, Sean. I would like to read this. It's Houdini versus the creator of Sherlock Holmes. I'm sure the story isn't as good, but what are you going to do? And then my last thing that I'll mention, Terry briefly mentioned the World of Krypton. So this is number two. Number one was last month. I believe this is DC's first miniseries. And this was, I also believe, originally supposed to be in Showcase. And they had it in the drawer. And then they, now it's half a year since the DC implosion. And so they decided to put it out as a miniseries and thus started the miniseries craze of the 80s. And Sean, what about our favorite Little Rich Guy?
We are not done at the newsstand. Go get your Twinkies. Go get your Yoo-Hoo if you're Rob. Because we have to talk about Richie Rich. My favorite number is 13. And it's a good number for Richie Rich because he has 13 books this month.
Down a little bit from his 16 of last month, but still pretty good.
Oh, it makes up for it because two of those books are digests. Richie Rich Digest Winners number 3 and Richie Rich Vacations Digest number 3. So that's pretty cool.
Terry, you made an excellent point about Neil Adams. I did look it up, of course, using the creator feature on Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics. And that is Neil's last cover for DC, other than the DC Special Blue Ribbon Digest number 16, which could very well have been produced earlier. And might be a reprint. I'd have to look at it until you get to 1983. So a gap of 4 years other than that digest when he does the covers for the reprints of the Green Arrow, Green Lantern series, which I definitely picked up when I was a kid.
Which is essentially him tracing himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. We are going to move on to the next story. And that next story is The Case of the Cavorting Corpse, starring Robin. It is 10 pages, written by Paul Kupperberg, penciled by Kurt Schaffenberger, and inked by Dave Hunt. It was later reprinted in Robin, the Bronze Age Omnibus hardcover from 2020. Robin in The Case of the Cavorting Corpse. Our story starts off the way most Bronze Age comic stories begin, with a body being thrown out of a car and smashing into a jackknifed tractor trailer. Robin and Chief McDonald are on the scene, standing over a body-draped sheet, which honestly should be a lot flatter than it seems. As they discuss Danny Hayes, the most recent member of the James Dean fan club, two youths try to approach the body. And since these guys are not traveling coroners, Robin has the idea that they might not be up to any good. His hunch proves correct when just moments later, they try to run him over in their car as they make their getaway. I don't mean a getaway to the Isle of a Thousand Thrills like your cousins Paul and Sean are planning this month. No. In a real, this meeting could have been an email moment. Chief McDonald calls Robin into his office to tell him that Danny Hayes' body is missing and they have no witnesses, no fingerprints, no sign of foul play. The next day, Dick is walking around New Carthage. He sees the same car that almost flattened him the previous day. And what's more, Danny Hayes is the one who's driving the car. Robin heads back to McDonald's office to go over Danny's personal effects since there were no clues to be found. Nothing like an airline ticket, diamond dust, not angel dust, and our old reliable friend, shoes with mud on them from one part of the city. Really? We should start to chant out loud together like we do after we mention JLGO. Robin heads off to New Carthage Lake, the only site on Earth with this particular type of mud, insert audio eye roll, where he finds the car that almost ran him over 3 days ago with the corpse of Danny in the front seat. A three-day-old, perfectly preserved corpse just sitting there, not decomposing or smelling bad. After finding a briefcase full of ice, diamond ice, not ice that you would use to preserve meat from rotting, Robin decides to sit in the car with a rotting corpse when the car mysteriously drives away on its own. Perhaps it's not so mysterious because the car has a remote radio-controlled mechanical apparatus attached to the steering wheel. When Robin arrives at his destination, he greets his new friends with a face full of briefcase and a stomach full of fist. Some balletic fighting ensues, and then Robin chases after one of the fleeing crooks through the forest. He then tells them to tell him what is going on twice. Apparently, instead of moving over into Detective Comics, this feature should have gone into Explain It To Me Comics. What did you think, Wardell Terry?
I got to correct you on one thing, Sean. It wasn't a three-day-old corpse. It was the next day. So the
okay.
He's only been dead a day. So he did. It's cute. It's all right. This does have one of those panels I told you has been in my head. On page 31, story page 9, Robin's chasing a guy through the woods, and he's thinking, that guy's got all the outdoors skill of a wounded bull moose. I'll bet he can hear him thrashing around all the way to Metropolis. And this has stuck with me. Anytime I take a walk in the woods, which is not nearly enough. If I'm in a hurry, if I start to move, don't care. I'll make enough sound they can hear me all the way to Metropolis. This has just been in my head over 40 years, that little bit.
Well, like in that panel, it's snap, crackle, crack instead of snap, crackle, pop.
It is a slight story. And it's easy to nitpick, this horrible detective work for the new Carthage police. How anybody can just go up to the body next to the car and not get caught. All that stuff is just so weird. I understand it's a comic. It's for kids. So we're not going to show a corpse with his head caved in and blood stained, stuff like that. I get it. It's all a big setup. But the notes I made about this bizarre story is the mystery is how'd they steal the body?
They didn't tell us that.
Does one of these kids, this electronics genius, does he have the key to the morgue? Did he do an internship there? There's a character who someone should dig up. This guy can rig up a car, he can drive remote control on turns and things like that.
From miles away. And Google's going to hire him, I think.
He knows how to steal bodies from a morgue. He could steal anything. There's a villain in training. I love the fight sequences.
Yeah.
That's my Robin. That's how he can fight. He can take care of. And he was joking a lot, too. He sounded more like Spider-Man than Robin.
A little bit. Yeah.
At least he's got personality. But there's a couple of pages. Dick's just walking downtown New Carthage with some college friends you've never seen before. Bob and Betsy.
Random new friends.
I get the Bob Rowe era for Robin is over. We're keeping Chief McDonald here, but nothing else is. We get no ramifications from the trauma. All these kids who are dying all over Hudson University. The classes are still going on, even though this big spy ring was just broken up recently. Weird school up there.
It is it's a weird school. Yeah, I liked it, Sean. It's interesting to me that we get Paul Kupperberg. It's essentially a fill-in issue right after Jaxie Harris started last issue. And then we get Jaxie Harris, again going forward. So I thought that was a little odd. I don't know whether they ran into deadline problems or what. I liked Schaffenberger's art better in this one. Robin still looks too young for me, still light, but there are a lot of great facial reactions on story page 3 where the kids drive off. Robin is not happy. He's frowning in the middle of the page there. I love that one. On page 4, his Dick's reaction when he sees the dead guy driving the car. He's like, huh? I think that's funny. Yeah. The jump up, conk the guy, whoops, the guy on the head.
Yeah.
Yes.
On page 9. So there's some good sequences here. Paced well for the length. Other than that, it's pretty thin that the guy would only deal with Danny. That's the whole crux of this whole sort of thing.
That's really
really kind of thin, but for a one and done light, as you say, Terry, Robin story, it's entertaining. Novelty factor of the dead guy driving the car pushes it into the fun category.
Exactly.
In a morbid kind of way.
I definitely love story page three, the top panel where Robin like jumps out of the way of the car. I think that's super, super cool.
Yeah, that's a good one too.
On the next page, story page five, the third panel where you have Robin, not just because you can see his, but I guess the coloring or whatever, and even just the way he's standing. There, I think he does look like a college student.
Yeah, there he looks.
I love that coloring.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got the faded shadows or something. Yeah, I agree with you, Sean.
I think Schaffenberg can make him look a little bit younger. But yeah, like the action on story pages 8 and 9, the bottom panel where he punches the guy in the stomach and he's like kicking and punching. All of those I think look great. The two things that bother me, there's absolutely no detective work. What? Because he makes such a big deal, like, oh, I can find clues where there aren't clues. Even though, like, there are three huge clues, like a ticket and document dust. It's not like these are hidden clues.
The thing that I did like, though, is he says, the chief says, there's not a clue on the lot. And Robin says, the man I worked for taught me where to look for clues when there aren't any. Aha. So I just like that real reference, the man I worked for.
I would like that reference if there was some, I don't know, he did a black light thing.
Yeah. If he used not, any sort of...
not like something in your pockets. He didn't turn out his pockets. That's the...
That's it.
But the thing that makes me most mad about this story is... it wasn't until I was reading my synopsis that I didn't make some kind of Weekend at Bernie's joke. That's what upsets me the most.
Oh, I appreciate that, Sean. That would be too obvious.
Think about it until now. It didn't even dawn on me.
You could have made a Lucky Stiff joke. I would have gotten that one. You know that musical?
I haven't heard that musical, no.
Oh, same kind of thing. There's a corpse that got to pretend is real. So one of the actors doesn't do anything. The whole play kept shoved around and stuck in places. The one-of-its-kind mud on the shoe. Other detective trope from comics is the matchbook from the club.
I'm more okay with a matchbook than I am with dirt from one part. Because matchbooks, that makes sense. If you go to the Atlantis Club, the Atlantis Club will have a matchbook that says the Atlantis Club.
You put it in your pocket, you'll commit your crime, you leave the matchbook behind. Yes.
But dirt from one part of...
All right, before this degenerates any further, I would like to do our Bat Family history on Kurt Schaffenberger.
Yay!
So Kurt Schaffenberger, of course, did the art for this. And I got some really neat sources for this. He's obviously been around a long time. But in particular, there was an interview with Kurt in The Amazing World of DC Comics number 2 from 1974. So see the gallery for the cover and the article, which I scanned, as well as a self-portrait that Kurt did of himself. From Jimmy Olsen, number 155 in 1973, and a DC profile of him that was presumably written by Bob Ruzakis. It's DC profile number 31. So I've included all that stuff in the gallery. Check them out. So Kurt Schaffenberger was born in 1920 on a farm in the Thuringian forest in Germany, where as a boy, he, quote, tended geese, herded goats, and hoed potatoes. So emigrating to America as a 7-year-old, first to Hartford, Connecticut, and then to New York City, he loved comic strips like the Katzenjammer Kids and Tarzan. He eventually won a scholarship to the Pratt Institute and graduated in 1941. After graduation, he briefly joined Jack Bender's studio, where he worked on key Fawcett titles, including Captain Marvel, Bullet Man, and Ibis the Invincible. He says, quote, I started at the bottom doing background work. The first thing I worked on was a Captain Marvel story. After a while, he got a chance to work on other features like Bullet Man and other Fawcett characters, but he didn't have any, quote, credited work, what we would call credited work as a primary artist until after the war, at least according to Mike's Amazing World. An interesting note is that while he was working for Bender's studio, which was located in Englewood, New Jersey, Schaffenberger took over an apartment from the local high school football coach named Vince Lombardi before he made his way to the NFL. Now, so Sean, Vince Lombardi was a famous coach in the 1950s and 60s. One of the most famous of all time, started with the Giant as an assistant coach and then moved most famously to the Packers where he won the first 2 Super Bowls. So just want to let you know, Sean.
I know that because of the trophy.
Okay, very good. Anyway, back to Schaffenberger. During World War II, Schaffenberger, of course, served in the military, first in the Special Services Division, planning entertainment for other outfits. He drew posters and was eventually noticed by an inspector general who elevated his profile. And he, quote, said, the most famous poster I did was a soldier helping himself to more food than he really needed. Superimposed over him was the spectral form of Hitler, cheering him on to waste the food. So I looked and looked to try to find this poster. I could not find it. There's lots of war posters online. So if any one of our Bat Kinfolk are better Google Foo martial artists than me or the Bronze Tiger, please look for it and post it in the comments. I couldn't find it. That sounds like a job for Isamu. Anyway, I found this next part interesting. From the Amazing World of DC Comics bio, also in World War II, Schaffenberger later served a stint with the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which of course later became the CIA. See showcase number 104 if you don't believe me. No, Kurt was not control. He served as a translator for spies. Of course, he spoke German, right? Spies were parachuted into Germany who transmitted intelligence from behind German lines on little mini radios. He said, quote, "There was always the possibility of them getting captured. If the enemy caught one of our people, they usually tried to force him to transmit false information to us and in turn to try to get as much information from us as possible. In that event, it became our responsibility to keep him alive, feeding him just enough false information to keep the enemy convinced that he was still useful to them." So he goes on to talk about how they arranged code phrases and the agents would use if they were captured. Heck, I've even seen that on Star Trek, right? He then describes one situation in particular, which was fascinating. One of our best agents was a professor in civilian life, a very gentle and soft-spoken man. He never cursed. So we arranged that if he was captured, he would slip some swear words into his messages. He was eventually caught, but our false information kept him alive. So that is just super cool. Here he is keeping these guys alive with working with them. I just think that's fantastic. After the war, he resumed his work for the Captain Marvel family of titles and expanded to reach an even more diverse group of publishing houses, including EC and Premier Magazines, ACG, and Timely Comics. His comics production is pretty thin in the early 1950s, leading me to believe that he was doing some other kind of work primarily, but I probably have to get that tomorrow's. There is a Tomorrow's biography that I also will list in the credits for those interested to be sure of that. Anyway, in 1957, Otto Binder, the brother of who he used to work for, recruited Schaffenberger to go work for DC to work on the Superman family of titles. He stayed at DC for the next 30 years, making an especially large contribution to the development of Lois Lane. In this capacity, he was the lead artist on Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane for series for pretty much the entirety of its first decade from 1958 to 1967. Schaffenberger's rendition of Lois became the definitive version of the character, and Schaffenberger was often asked by DC editor Mort Weisinger to, what do you think, to redraw other artists' depiction of Lois Lane on the titles where she appeared. Of interest to our Bat family, famously, Catwoman made her first appearance in the Silver Age in Superman's Girlfriend Lois Lane number 70 from 1966 in a story drawn by Schaffenberger. It was only a few months after that that we got Catwoman Set Her Claws on Batman, the 197. That was the issue following the Batgirl breaks up the dynamic duo that we reviewed way back in the reprint era of Batman Family. He was one of the creators, also linking to a prior segment, that he was essentially fired from DC in 1970 for helping to organize some of the other artists to get access to healthcare and working conditions and all the rest. We talked about that before. But he did return to DC only a little more than a year later, and he did a bunch of Jimmy Olsen's. When in the 1970s, DC acquired the rights to the Marvel family, Schaffenberger was one of the key players in the revival of those characters. He did that book after C.C. Beck left, before Don Newton. And then throughout the 70s and until early 80s, he worked on various Superman titles, including the Lois Lane and other features in the subject of Sean's next podcast, The Superman Family, and his newest favorite series, The New Adventures of Superboy. He did that title as well. Somewhat metaphorically, the Superboy and Supergirl-less DC universe that followed the Crisis turned out to be a mostly Schaffenberger-less one as well. He largely retired from comics soon after, helping ink Kurt Swan's pencils on the final pre-Crisis Superman tale, Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, of course, written by Alan Moore. Schaffenberger passed away in 2002 at the age of 82 after a fantastic career. According to Mike's Amazing World, he had 534 story credits, totaling over 6,500 pages and about 200 covers to boot. So thanks for letting me talk about this. I thought he was a terrifically interesting subject and gave me a greater appreciation. Hope you enjoyed that.
One of my favorite artists is Mike Parabek. And you definitely can see the style of Kurt Schaffenberger for Mike Parabek. I just love that clean line style.
Yeah, I hear you. It's not my favorite. I don't like his look of Robin, but he can tell a story. He's clean. It's accessible. Loved Mr. and Mrs. Superman. Batman. Mm-hmm. Thought that was very appropriate for that strip, right? You know, he needs to be on the right strip. Yeah, after getting Don Newton and others on Robin, he just it was just a come down.
When I was younger, I didn't enjoy him, and now I can really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Because you look at any page of Schaffenberger, look at any panel of Schaffenberger, and you can't say, oh, he did this wrong.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He did nothing wrong. It's a style that doesn't really mesh with the Neil post
more modern. It's old fashioned
superhero comics. It is old fashioned, but it's perfect. Yeah. It's just right.
Okay, let's move on to the fateful finale, which is of course starring the Demon, written by Len Wein and with art by Steve Ditko, a 12 pager later reprinted in the Steve Ditko Omnibus Volume 2, and that's the only place it's been reprinted. So our story starts off with a retcon of the ending last issue. Here we see an expanded version of the Demon approaching Abner Beckerman, a successful businessman, and telling him that he now needs to take care of the Eternity Book since his brother Aldo is dead. But Abner wants nothing to do with the Arcane, so after the Demon leaves, he tosses the book into the trash. Very different than the Demon sitting on that lady's desk last issue. But what are you going to do? Meanwhile, the Demon returns to Jason Blood's apartment and transforms back into Jason so that he can get out of that wrestling diaper and dressed in a swanky outfit with an ascot. But as he enters his living room, he sees that his friends have been captured by Baron Time. They are being suspended in midair, and Time threatens Jason that if he doesn't give him the Eternity Book, he will hurt his friends, or worse. Jason tells him that he doesn't know where it is since the Demon disposed of it before he came home. But if you want Etrigan, you can have him. Gone, gone, the form of man. Rise the Demon Etrigan. We get a little Ditko battle weirdness, but then Time has an idea. He says, forget about the book. I will tap into the same power that transforms you from Jason to Etrigan to fix my half and half situation. And if you don't help me, I will kill your friends. Reluctantly, Etrigan agrees. He starts to become half and half as Time is becoming whole. Just go with it. It's comic book magic. Anyway, the three friends literally put their heads together and somehow use telekinesis or magic or something to turn the lights out. For some reason, this throws the spell out of whack. And as Time adjusts, he turns and faces Jason slash Etrigan and prepares his final spell. But it somehow backfires on him, and Time ends up losing his humanity and is exiled from Earth. Turns out, when it was dark, Jason slash Etrigan had moved the mirror so that the spell Time cast was just reflected right back at him. The friends are glad that Time is gone, and now the Eternity Book is in safe hands. They can rest easy. But is it? That night, a janitor is cleaning Mr. Beckerman's office, and he finds the Eternity Book in the trash. He says, huh, I'll give it a read. Who knows what I can learn from it? The end? What'd you guys think?
I liked the bookend structure of the story, how we start with the book in Beckerman's office, and we end with the book being removed from Beckerman's office. It's a nice little demonic fight. Good trick by the Demon. Ditko was careful what the Demon is reflected in the mirror. He is drawing him backward from how he had been shown.
Yeah.
Everybody has huge hands in this story. I don't know why. And I do like the way that Ditko draws the Demon. Demon's always hunched over. He's always in motion. Even when he's defeated, when he agrees to let Baron Time take his dual essence away, he's slumped over. There's no motion in the body, but there's a lot of language in the body. So nice job there. I do have an issue with how Ditko draws his friend Glenda, because Glenda looks like, well, looks like a woman you could buy and inflate. Let's just put it that way.
Sean, how about you? What is your initial reactions?
I like it. Now, obviously, I'll say I would much rather have Michael Golden do the artwork. Absolutely, absolutely. But I actually really like Ditko's art on this. It's fun. It's light. It's breezy. I do absolutely love, he says, I don't care how valuable this dusty old book is. If you think I'm going to keep something that could cost me my life, mister, you're absolutely out of your mind. That's like,
yes.
That is the exact opposite of comic book logic. That's like real life logic.
Exactly.
I love that part. I think that's fantastic. I also think it's great at the very end. I love that J. Jonah Jameson comes in and gets the book. I think that's
Yeah. You know, what I thought about this was interesting is it feels to me like Len Wein had the story end the last issue. And then Paul Levitz or somebody asked him, hey, can we get another issue out of it?
Yeah.
Because they added the hands of Baron Time coming out of the rubble. Because this doesn't feel as connected to the rest of the story. I enjoyed it, But I love those other three parts. And this one's kind of a bookend, I guess. It's weird. I like the ending. I like the fact that the janitor goes. I always love those. It's the Indiana Jones thing where who knows who's going to find it in the warehouse kind of thing.
Little O. Henry kind of ending.
Yeah. So I love all that stuff. So it's a good departure. So all the people who are complaining about the demon being in Batman Family, well, watch out. Now you're getting a whole bunch of other people that aren't even as close as the demon. Be careful what you wish for, people.
Yes.
I enjoyed it overall. But it's lighter weight than the others, I think.
Yes.
I don't really have beats to kind of walk through. I mean, that was
It's just one long fight sequence.
Yeah. I like the way he dresses. I mean, I really have enjoyed Ditko's art in all three of these. If we couldn't get Michael Golden for all of it, if we could have got Ditko for the whole thing, you know, it might have been neat. Because this story's not been reprinted in its entirety anywhere, because the Michael Golden piece might be in his book, but
yeah, it would look really odd to put in.
It would look very odd. Unfortunately,
Ditko suffers by comparison.
I agree.
Ditko's, the way he draws people at 1979, people still look like they're drawn 1970 or 1969.
Yeah.
Same thing with, well, not so much his book Shade, which had been out a couple of years earlier, but nothing looked up to date in Steve Ditko's stories after a certain point.
Yeah, that's true. And I remember when I got Adventure Comics, I only got Adventure Comics for Plastic Man. Like, I didn't even bother with Starman. But now,
I like the Starman feature.
I have all of those issues because of Plastic Man. I think I would be interested more now to go back and read Starman and be okay with that art now. It's funny because at the time it was just way too old fashioned. But now, 40 years later,
I definitely appreciate his art a lot more now that I'm older, without question. Yeah. I mean, there's still things that he wasn't well suited for. He was not suited for the Legion of Superheroes. I think that was...
No.
I recently did a Legion read of a whole bunch of issues and I got through those and I was like, man, that was just bad. This demon stuff's great. I like the Shade stuff and I like...
Yeah, Shade is wonderful.
Starman stuff. So, you know, what are you going to say? All right.
Now we are going to focus on the inside covers. We're going to start off with the Batcave feature. So basically it's Paul Levitz with his editorial. There's a whole lot. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to pull out a couple of things. The first thing he says is, with this issue, we're now in full swing of the new Detective Comics. All of the changes in the series have begun to click. The writers and artists are turning out some of their best work. And we're very excited about the results. I think our comments might be a little bit different this issue, but okay.
I took the full swing comment to mean that burned off the inventory. They got rid of all the crap like the Galileo solution. And now they're moving forward.
Maybe that starts next issue.
Maybe.
But one thing I wanted to point out is the next paragraph, he says, Maxi Zeus is scheduled to return next issue with the puzzling Revenge of a Paltry God, a tale Denny O'Neill describes as our annual attempt to do a Simon Pure detective story. So Captain Entropy, what does that mean? Is that a fair play story? Which I'm hoping that means...
I'm thinking you might get your fair play story next issue.
A Simon Pure? I'm learning so much about detective stories now that it's switched over to Detective Comics. And then on the inside back cover...
Oh, wait, before you get that, I have one last comment.
Yeah.
I did notice there is no mention. He talks about the features in Detective Comics and all the rest. But you know one thing that Paul Levitz does not mention? The Batman Family. So he's not using that terminology. And I think this supports the fact that we've been saying that he sees Detective as an anthology. You're going to get members of the Batman Family. In every issue, you get Batman, Robin, and Batgirl. But other than that, open the floodgates is, I think, the attitude that he has. Anyway, that's just my inference, I guess, from
reading. Because the inside back cover letter column, it does say Batcave. It doesn't say Batmail Family. Yeah.
Right.
But we do still want to invite Rex Arnold, Edward Villa, and Roger Scowcroft onto the show because you had letters printed. So please, we've had letter writers on our show before. We'd love to have you on. So there's only two comments that I really want to talk about. In the first letter, Rex Arnold, he talks about he's fine for the occasional use of such masters of evil as the Joker, Two-Face, Ra's al Ghul, and Catwoman. He said, this line is something you could only read in a comic book. I'd also like to see the return of Hugo Strange despite his recent death. I love that. I absolutely love it. Even though he's dead, love to have him back driving a car. But then he also goes on to say, I also think you should run some interconnected series through Batman and Detective that would last for several months. I agree with that. And apparently they're doing that with the League of Assassins. The next one, I'm actually going to read the entire letter from Roger Schoolcraft, and I am going to read this verbatim. I did not change any word of this letter that I'm going to read verbatim from beginning to end. Dear editor, when I heard you were planning on a Batmite story, I cringed. They can't do this, I said, destroying the credibility of a top-notch comic just because of that elf appearing on the Batman cartoon show. Now that it's appeared, and despite my willingness to dislike it, I liked it. Better than that, I loved it. In fact, it's one of the few comic stories that's actually made me laugh out loud, despite what Brett Young said about it. Yes, I really enjoyed the Batmite story, but I hope you've now gotten it out of your system and will put him to rest. Contrary to the popular TV show, once is enough. Roger Schoolcraft.
But I thought you'd go to the answer of that, Sean.
He says, fear not, Batmite is indeed out of our hearts and minds. But we do have a Bat-Hound story we want to... No? Oh, wait. No, I didn't want to read that. That's horrible. Dangling it out from... There's an Everything But the Girl song called Each and Every One with the line, you tried to show me heaven and then slammed the door. No, that's exactly what they're doing to me. I don't like it at all.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. All right, let's move on to our fourth story, starring Batgirl in The Case of the Untouchable Crook, an 11-pager by Jack C. Harris, with art by Don Heck, inked by John Salardo, reprinted in the Bronze Age Omnibus Volume 2. We open in our favorite Congresswoman's apartment, which is in the process of being robbed. Fortunately, Babs put her Batgirl outfit on instead of her PJs and easily takes out the thug. He had been looking for her files regarding Congressman Cartwright, who is suspected of taking kickbacks from the country of Sarandia. But after the police are called, we find out that they can't hold the burglar named Anton Karyov since he has diplomatic immunity as part of the Sarandian embassy. Whew, that was a tough paragraph to read, listeners. After a quick change back to Batgirl, Babs hops on her Batbike, chasing after Karyov. But he sees her and takes a shot at her bike, blowing out the front tire. Babs is able to save herself, but the bike crashes and is totaled. Not only has Batgirl lost Karyov, she is now without wheels. The next day, Babs is participating in a hearing regarding Congressman Cartwright, who is particularly argumentative, but they have no proof of Cartwright taking any money, so he walks. Babs is feeling the case slip away, but later that night, the congressman's secretary, Gloria Mann, comes to her office asking for help. She is scared and ready to turn on her boss. Babs says she will get Batgirl to help her. Still later, Gloria makes a rendezvous with Karyov to get a case of money for the congressman. But guess what? Babs has done a human target and is masquerading as Gloria. She easily takes him down as the FBI boys listen in. But in a twist, Karyov says he wants to be granted asylum to stay in the U.S. and testify against Cartwright. He would rather face U.S. prosecution than go home, where he is sure to be executed. The end. So what did you guys think of this story? Terry, let's start with you.
It's a pretty good story. Yeah. This is, didn't do enough research, just a quick research. The year before this was published was the Abscam scandal, in which seven members of the United States Congress were convicted of bribery and corruption. Members of both parties. Just your garden variety crook. So that's a nice element to the story. I like how Salado adds a little bit of depth to Heck's drawing. Some of these panels look really good. The first panel, I love how the crook looks. Batgirl doesn't look so great. Unfortunately, I like how she does her change from Batgirl to Babs.
Oh, I love
which
that.
Is, yeah, it's very much reminiscent of her very first appearance. She changes her cowl into her hat, tape becomes a skirt, changes color somehow, all that.
At least she's not putting on her boots in the junk of the Island of Thousand Thrills, right?
Yeah, good action sequences. A couple of weird things, though. How did she get an apartment in Washington D.C. that had a wall safe?
Oh, I'm sure Brett will have something to say about this. This apartment is humongous, and it's in Washington, and she's a first-term congresswoman. Yeah.
The bat cycle gets blowed up. She has to think about it. It's going to be weeks to reconstruct a similar cycle. There's been occasional moments of that before, many, many issues ago, when she had to take an airplane flight and said, this is going to put a huge dent in my budget. She's not like all these other superheroes that just, I got my own private plane. I'll fly someplace. I got my own. I'll go get another vehicle. No, she may be a member of Congress. She has to work for a living.
That's a favorite reference here at the reunion table.
Oh, yeah.
And I like the nice little touch of the diplomatic immunity aspect. I don't think that was touched on much in these comics.
So what did you think, Sean?
Well, I can tell you one thing. I like your recap better than the story. I am very disappointed that I didn't pick up on the human targetness of her.
I did that. I put that in there for you.
And I liked that part of the story. I'm disappointed I didn't realize it. Bat Cousins, if you are driving, I need you to pull over. Whoever is listening to this right now, I need you to be in the frame of mind where you are about to be stunned and amazed by words that I am going to utter, because I am going to say something very lovingly about the artwork of Don Heck.
Wow. Which
never, ever happens. His crook on page one, top of the chart, fantastic representation. I cannot believe how good that crook guy is. Looks the lighting from the pen light. That is phenomenal.
I agree. That crook looks, it's a shame that the Batgirl figure looks like one of those things you hang on the wall with the movable arms.
Oh, yes. I don't even think it's that good. For once in my life, I wish this were a video podcast, because she almost looks like the Hulk. Her body posture is horrific, which is in line with what I think of Don Heck.
And if you look at the last two pages of the story, he's very consistent with that crook.
Yeah, yeah.
He has a look. The action is understandable. He does a really good job in the last two pages. Story's kind of muddled in between. The other muddled.
Yeah.
I think the whole sequence in the House of Representatives was really unnecessary.
Yeah.
The secretary wanting to turn, she's like, it's 4 years since the last election, but he's a congressman, not a senator. So that doesn't make sense.
And on page seven, she follows him to the airport. Then one panel later, she's back in her apartment building.
Yeah, there's a lot of gaps.
Yeah.
Like I said last issue, Jaxie Harris is not Bob Ruzakis, although he does, Sean, give everybody a name.
I was actually wondering, the secretary, when she says, I'm Gloria Mann, did she win a contest to appear in a comic book story, like through a serial? Because I was wondering about it. I've heard of Abscam. I don't know exactly what that is. I read this story three times in preparation for this. I didn't understand that part at all. I'm glad the Gloria thing came after, because that I liked a lot.
Yeah, I do like at the ending how Batgirl isn't happy that this guy who's kind of a slime ball is going to, you know, get asylum in the U.S. But that's, prosecutors make deals all the time to catch, quote, the bigger fish, right? And so that's a little bit of realism added in, which, you know, I like. The only part I didn't understand that you didn't mention, Sean, was Karyov keeps calling Batgirl a demon girl. And I don't understand why he was so spooked by Batgirl. She's not that spooky looking. I don't know.
Look at that first panel again.
Yeah, I guess so.
She's possessed.
Okay, now one of the absolute best things about this issue, SST, the supersonic threat, featuring the return of Man-Bat, thank God. 11 pages written by Bob Ruzakis, penciled by Don Newton, inked by Frank McLaughlin, and this was later reprinted in Never. That's a shame. Aww. I guess I should put my energies towards a Man-Bat reprint instead of a Spider-Woman reprint, but I already have the Man-Bat issues, so I need Spider-Woman more than Man-Bat.
Great trade paperback. Man-Bat in the Bronze Age. You start off with the Neil Adams stuff. You go through this stuff.
Marshall Rogers, Michael Golden, Don Newton. Look at that.
You'd have all kinds of great artists in this.
Mm. Man-Bat in SST, the supersonic threat. Our story starts off the way most Bronze Age comic stories begin, with a demonic-looking creature bottle-feeding a baby at 3 a.m. But the story proper begins on the next page, in the office of Bard and Langstrom PIs, where they are commiserating over the fact that there's no new business coming in. After a one-page Man-Bat origin recap, new business does come in. Mrs. Elliot asks the detective to follow her husband Wayne, who instead of coming home at 5:30, has now been arriving at 8, but when she phones his work, the calls never go through. Langstrom secretly tails Wayne Elliott. Well, I mean, I guess anytime someone tails someone, it's in secret, right? To a remote laboratory where he's putting on an Iron Man, Rocket Red, third-rate knockoff Transformers mech suit. Kool-Aid Manning his way through a window causes him to fly right into Man-Bat in a fantastic full-action panel shot. Since his bat sense wasn't tingling, Manbat surmises that SST isn't a villain, but he is doing some serious property building damage. Brett Young will be guesting in the feedback section to tell us how far property rates will fall, and decides that he has to stop him on his dangerous flight path. Now look, all you Bat Cousins know that I love Manbat, but his plan to create turbulence by flapping his wings is maybe less born of intelligence and more from the lack of sleep due to the 3 a.m. feedings. But what do I know? Because voila, it works. Our last four panels aren't exactly a Razakis recap, but it does tell us that all of the money the Elliots have will now be going to fix the city damages and not into the pockets of Bard and Langstrom, P.I. What did you guys think? Let's start with Ward Hill Terry.
I love this story. I loved Manbat. This is his penultimate appearance in this book, which is really too bad because right after this, they ruin his character in DC. This is my Manbat. This is Kirk, private investigator, Francine. Everything's cool with them now. Don Newton art is absolutely gorgeous. On that second page, that thing that Jason is doing with the pencils, that's one of those things that's been stuck in my head ever since I read this in 1979.
I love what he's doing with the pencil, but his legs don't look quite right to me. That's the one knock on Don Newton's art I'm going to make.
Why do you think he uses a cane?
That's like burying the lead. Jason Bard can balance a pencil on his finger and then a pencil on top of that pencil. That is superhuman skill. That's more than Daredevil. I understand you want to illustrate boredom or whatever, but the fact that he's balancing a pencil on his finger, that is spectacular. Like, that's a talent. You could go on Gotham's Got Talent and win the whole competition with that.
You can see he cheated it on page 4. He's sticking the pencil tip into the eraser. Cute trick, eh?
Still, I think it's still remarkable.
There's no reason for that to be in the story, but it's in the story, and it looks great because it's a regular thing.
Yeah.
He's just, you know, they're chatting in the office, and he's playing with a pencil. I love that bit.
I like the little origin. Manbat's been a few issues.
Very concise, one-page recap of the origin. Love it. I love this, the guy testing out his brand new super suit and failing miserably, because this has to happen all over New York and Gotham Metropolis and Central City. People trying these things out. Sometimes you read about them, they're successful, either on the good side or the bad side, but DC Universe is full of great inventors, and sometimes they're not so great.
I like how this guy even looks like Tony Stark.
Yes, yes, he does.
But what is the great Caroptica?
Oh, he's used that phrase before. That's a bat phrase.
Is it the genus or species or the Egyptian? It's something like that. I almost think this is a great story in spite of itself, because really the story is the detectives are down on their luck. They need business. This woman comes in. She probably thinks her husband's cheating. He has this mech suit, but he doesn't want to be a villain. He just can't control it. Manbat flaps his wings and stops it. But it is an enjoyable story.
Yeah.
But let's talk about page 7. I mean, that is a fabulous splash page. That's just great. The great aerial battle.
Yeah.
You know, it's just all really good.
It's really gorgeous.
But I did like what I thought was a really neat point that Bob Razakis makes at the end. Yeah, you know, this guy wanted to be a superhero. He was going to call himself SST, the supersonic turkey, I guess. Working so on something for so long, having to get out of control. And Jason Barr's like, yeah, kind of like Manbat. And he's like, oh, you know, I guess I shouldn't throw too many stones, right? I thought that was a terrific little callback.
Yeah.
I think the story was very well constructed by Bob. You've got the origin in there. You've got the clearly delineated, this guy wants to be a hero. Yeah, Manbat.
Also a reflection on current concerns of the supersonic transport issue at Concord coming into New York City then. A lot of people didn't want it.
Yep. All kinds of stuff. Just a great 11-page story. I enjoyed that quite a bit.
And this story was edited by Al Milgrom. So it's been sitting in the drawer for quite a few months.
That's a good catch.
Well, that's fantastic, because on page 11, when he's reading the New York Planet, you see Manbat grounds Jet Menace. But the article to the right of that, it says Milgrom something team routes.
I think it's the Milgrom volleyball team routes.
Volleyball team, yeah. So Al Milgrom, famous for putting things in panels.
That's too funny. Yeah, that's awesome.
I really, really liked the Bard Langstrom Detective Agency.
And so do I.
There had been more stories about it.
I really do. So this would never, ever happen. But remember, like, back in the days when the DC Universe app had the TV programming on it?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How fantastic would it be to have Langstrom and Bard PI show? Oh, my God.
Yes.
70s style. Oh, my God. I would love that. So now we are going to take a trip to Gabriel's Horn, the hip happening hangout for the Teen Titans in the 1970s. We'll talk about the most 1970s moments in this issue from any of the stories. Wardell Terry, we're going to start with you. Do you have anything?
The only one I mentioned before, the Abscam scandal,
yeah,
the SST concerns. I didn't find anything really good in any of the stories, but I do have one thing, but I'd rather share it at the end after you guys say your stuff.
Yeah, mine are few and not good.
Martial arts in general was a 70s thing from the first story. Alfred comes in with a piece of paper on page 7 with the info about the car. There's computers on pages 10 and 11 that the guy is looking at that look like old-fashioned computers. But other than that, there's not much in the Batman story. And Robin, the big one I had, the kid that gets launched out of the convertible, clearly he was not wearing his seatbelt. That's the one I had in Robin. And the case full of diamonds, probably worth way more than $500,000 today. Do you have anything in Robin?
The big clunky remote control driving device.
Yeah.
The other one is the actual paper airline ticket.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's it for that one.
In the Demon, we've struggled to find anything in the Demon stories. Clothing is very dated, as you mentioned, Terry. But the only thing I found is the janitor at the end.
Yep.
You know, it's amazing. The world's running out of coal and oil and good 10-cent cigars.
Yep.
That was my favorite. I like that one. How about Batgirl, Sean?
I didn't realize it was a takeoff of the ab scam.
I mean, you've clearly got Eastern European Cold War type stuff going on here. Yeah. She's got papers in her safe. Nowadays, the guy'd be sneaking in and putting a flash drive in her computer. The woman's a secretary, not an administrative assistant. But that's it. And then I don't really have anything in Man Bat unless you did.
For Man Bat, I have SST, Supersonic Transport, which is a Concorde. Yeah.
I found a unifying feature in all five stories.
Oh, let's hear it.
At least one gentleman in each story is wearing a 3-piece suit. Jacket, vest, and tie.
Nicely
if we include
done.
Alfred. Alfred's in two panels. Okay. I think he's got a vest on. But
that'll count.
There's at least one guy with a 3-piece suit. And I had one myself in 1979. I got the year before for an 8th grade graduation.
Yeah, look at that. There it is in that one, 3-piece suit. Yeah, how about that? Nicely done, Terry.
All right.
Before we sign off, tell our listeners where they can find you.
I'm at Ward Hill Terry. I'm on most of the social media that way. I'm also playing a rock and roll band called Stop Calling Me Frank. And we're also on the social medias and on Rum Bar Records. And you can get a Rum Bar Record sampler right now, year end free record, free CD. Go to the Rum Bar Records on their site or also on Bandcamp and put zero in how much money you want to pay for it. And you get 20 to 30 songs, including one of our songs.
All right.
If you like the rock and roll, Sean M. Myers does not like the rock and roll. He's a Broadway guy. Yeah.
Well, we appreciate you being on, Terry. We're going to now play a podcast promo. When we return, Sean and I will read and respond to your listener feedback.
Siskoid watches a lot of movies, like a lot. So now he has his own movie podcast, or several. Siskoid Cinema is your one-stop umbrella for a variety of shows like Fade In, exploring the first films of famous actors and directors.
This is a joke, right?
On Borrowed Time, discussing all your favorite time travel movies.
Whoa, this is heavy.
Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
And No Escape from Kurt Russell, a dissection of the man, the mystique, and the movies.
There goes a perfectly good bumper sticker.
And more. Siskoid Cinema, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome back. Before we start, we received an iTunes review way back in August from Rocky Starwind. Sorry for the delay, Rocky. He says, great show, and the guests and hosts have a lot of fun. I can't wait to hear the stories with two of my favorites, The Atom and The Demon. Thanks, Rocky. We hope you enjoyed our coverage of The Demon stories, and of course, The Atom is coming up. Now, we're going to read and respond to your listener feedback for episode 484, Purple Pants, Flying Graysons, and the Galileo Solution, with our special guest, Brett Young. Bucky749 kicks us off by letting us know that he is enjoying the Batman Scooby-Doo team-up movies. And then Eric says, another great fun-filled episode. I'm both looking forward to and dreading the next episode, knowing what's in store for one of our favorite Batman family members in issue 485. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Bat cousin Lizanne Oswald says, impressive podcast, most impressive. I like the cover. I wasn't digging the purple pants, Sean, but you may have a point. Maybe we could double date these two dapper men. You can have the guy in the purple pants since you saw him first. The man with the killer sideburns may be able to make my day. Boom, boom. I see what you did there, Lizanne. The human target story is pretty cool. Turtlenecks are cool, and he looks hot in it. This is madness. I'm digging those nurse's bracelets. And Babs is talking about how someone else dresses. Girl, she needs to look back at her Hall of Shame wardrobe from the past. Kitty Pride feels bad for Babs. Robin's story was good. Though, geez, y'all are right. He was drawn young in this. Can't wait to hear the next episode. Thanks, Lizanne.
Next up, Bat Nephew Isamu Hideki Yukinori says, since the series was brought up in the discussion with Uncle Brett, I have to say that my biggest problem with Identity Crisis is that it was not a Fair Play murder mystery. In fact, in my first and only reread of the series, the whole mystery did not make any sense at all. It felt like the direction of the plot was changed a few times as the story was being written slash produced. So this is Sean interjecting. Yeah, we hear instances of that all the time where the writer has an idea for the story and then editorial changes it. There's the whole big thing. Was it Armageddon 2001 where the bad guy was supposed to be Hawk?
No. It was supposed to be Captain Atom and they changed it.
Yeah, so I think that happens a lot more than we even know. So back to Isamu. We also have the Hembeck Omnibus, which unfortunately is not a great reproduction of Dad's copies of Fantico magazines, including the Dateline columns. So what that sound is, that's the sound that Qbert makes when he gets hit by a ball, and it's the swear words in the all like comic fonts. So that's my audio version of the swear word for Dateline columns. It is also too bad that the Daily Planet strips are not included. Many of them have great dad jokes about the DCU, but Mike's Amazing World has a page collecting every Daily Planet DC Comics news page, so they all can be read there.
Okay, so, wow, Isamu, I never knew this. Somehow I have missed it in my extensive use of Mike's Amazing World. Yet another reason that is one of the best websites of all time. I have spent the last couple of days doing nothing but reading Daily Planets. I also have to thank my back cousin Sean, because a few days before Christmas, the Hembeck Omnibus showed up in my mailbox, and I am enjoying it immensely now. So thanks again, cousin Sean.
I'm super glad Isamu pointed that out. However, I have not gone there because I'm still reading so much stuff. Paul sent me a bunch of Christmas comics, and I still haven't even finished them. And we're recording the day after Christmas, and I haven't even gotten through half of those. I have a ton of backlog. I'm getting those Mighty Marvel Masterworks, and I'm like 3 or 4 behind of those, and I never am. So I'm purposefully not going to go to the Daily
You'll get sucked in. You'll get sucked in.
Yes, I know. So I'll save that for probably this time next year when I'm reading all this stuff I've backlogged. But we are going to get back to Isamu now. Dad also mentioned in his commemorative art book. Oh, yeah, that's another book. So the Zoom Yukinori book. I'm only like a quarter of that, but I purposefully only read 2 or 3 or 4 or 7 pages a day to like make it last. So he mentioned in his commemorative art book on page 197 that Mr. Hembeck's Dateline interviews with comic book characters was a likely inspiration to the format of his Done in One Wonders podcast. And if you haven't listened to Zoom's podcast, it's fantastic. Speaking of that, thanks for the kind words about Dad's book, Uncle Sean. We hope you enjoy the rest of it. I am loving it. Thanks a lot.
Rob McCarthy just had to add that, predictably, I'm glad someone wanted more Joker stories. I'm required to say that. And then Bat Cousin and network co-founder Chris Franklin pipes in, fun episode, guys. To discuss the elephant in the room, I agree with Nephew Isamu that Identity Crisis isn't a very good mystery, on top of sullying an era of comics that didn't deserve it. But as for this issue of Detective, somehow I've never read this one. I remember a house ad for this cover and being concerned for Commissioner Gordon, but the dreaded newsstand denied me again. I'll hop over to DCIU and check it out.
And then the guest from this very episode, our Bat Band member Ward Hill Terry, joins in on the fun. I am eager to try that eggnog recipe. I thought you two were too hard on the Human Target story. That story was much more of a mystery than the Batman story. What detective work did Batman do? He knew where his antagonist was and fought his way through the traps to get him. The human target had to solve a mystery of a threat to his life. Both stories had plenty of action, but superhero comics generally do. Action slash adventure? I guess adventure stories in film and fiction involve dangerous river or ocean crossings, jungle settings, and wild animals. Action stories are a lot of chases. Regarding the explosion in Commissioner Gordon's office, the outer wall and most of the window frames seem undamaged. It looks as if when the commissioner realized he was holding an infernal device, he immediately threw it at the window. The glass is clearly shattered, but no great harm was done. Ochsner knew what he was doing. Excellent feature on him.
So I have to break in here, Sean. I like that explanation.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic.
That is now in my head. So good on you, Jim Gordon, for throwing that thing right out the window.
That's a fantastic no prize. I agree with the general consensus on Schaffenberger's art on Robin. He didn't give us the more mature Irv Novick, Mike Grell, Don Newton Robin we Bat-Fam readers had enjoyed. That last panel is terrific, though. The second Batman story sure seemed like inventory filler, but I don't think the demon stories were. The timeline of when Len Wein came back to DC and when Michael Golden started indicate that these were stories newly created. Wein clearly had a multi-part story planned, and Ditko was able to jump in and finish it.
Bat-nephew Isamu returns for a few additional thoughts. To answer Uncle Sean's question about Batman fighting a dog, a Batman story in Detective Comics number 500, oh no, not that one, the one with Deadman in it, involved a hitman named Stryker who used a poisonous attack dog to kill Batman. Then Isamu inserted a page from Detective 500 illustrating the fact. He then continues his comments about the human target. I love the old TV show that aired on ABC way before my time, done by the same guys who did the 1990 Flash TV series, because that Christopher Chance did the whole disguise routine. Too bad I can only watch these episodes on a bootleg DVD my dad got at a convention. As for this story, I thought it was pretty brilliant how he actually showed us who Floyd Fetterman was on page 2, and so then he inserted another panel where we do see Fetterman leaving the restaurant at the beginning of the story. Yeah, we should have mentioned that, Isamu. I don't know how we missed saying that. Obviously, the bad guys saw Fenderman visit the restaurant and assumed, correctly, that he went there to see Chance, though they didn't realize that Fenderman missed his chance to meet with Christopher. That girl in Bat Family history. This issue was not actually Bob Ochsner's debut in Detective, for he penciled the Batgirl story in the previous issue. Oops, my bad. I think I misspoke there. Good catch, Isamu. Bad Uncle Paul's Bat Family History segment gives us a better idea why that story had so many views of Bab's bat backside. And in the very last panel of the Robin story, will Robin re-ask the question about what moved the trapeze? The final caption provides the answer. It was the wind. And then the demon. I think the demon's addition to the Batman Family title was originally another DC Explosion extra feature, like adding the human target in Brave and the Bold and Airwave and Action Comics. At least the story has him facing an old Man-Bat villain so that there would be a bit of a connection in addition to the ones you mentioned. If you think that because version of the demon looked weird, just wait until you see the composite blood demon in the next issue. Yeah, that was creepy. Unsolved Cases of Batman. This was actually a DC Explosion feature that started in Batman 305 and ended in 307, with, I guess, the story plan for 308 moved here along with the human target. Just like this final feature, the unsolved aspect of the early stories never lived up to the title of the feature, despite the great art by Michael Golden and Don Newton. One would think that Batman would be glad that the secret of such a deadly solvent would be lost forever, so no one would be able to use it for nefarious purposes. Yeah, I'm with you, Isamu. I don't think this was such a great invention. And then Bat Timeline, Green Lantern and Green Arrow wouldn't be able to go beyond one page in a confrontation with Joker and Two-Face, I'm sure. And then maybe after the Batman Family Reunion wraps up, you can spin off the second part of your Bat Timeline segment into its own podcast called Alfred, Let's Go Shopping, where you two and a guest visit a particular week of Mike's Amazing World and pick the comics you want to buy based on the covers. This can be done, of course, after Uncle Sean's Superman Family Album podcast, of course. I look forward to the next reunion, Uncle Gentlemen. Thank you, as always, Isamu.
Bat Cousin Martin Menza adds his 2 cents. I, too, own a copy of that Hembeck omnibus. It is awesome. As for the human target inventory, he was originally slated during the DC Explosion to to be the ongoing backup in The Brave and the Bold. So moving it over to this Batman title made sense. Now this is Sean interjecting. I actually have printed out from Mike's Amazing World a list of Human Target stories, and it was actually for my history lesson, and I just never took it down from my wall. Christopher Chance was in two issues of The Brave and the Bold, 143, 144, and then he moved over to Detective with 483. So yeah, Martin is exactly correct. And next up, Bat Cousin Brian Schufo stops by. Hi, Bat Cousins and Bat Nephews and Bat Uncles. We really should remove that get rid of slimy girls sign out front. This is Sean interjecting. Yeah, I absolutely agree with Brian. If there's any women who want to come on the show, absolutely, please let us know. Yeah, we welcome everybody to the reunion. Absolutely. Thanks for bringing that up, Brian. I brought some Grey Goose vodka to toast all incarnations of the Flying Graysons and all last names starting with Gray and Gray, G-R-A-Y and G-R-E-Y. This issue probably came out just before Buck Rogers in the 25th century, but I'll always drink a toast to Aaron Gray. I really love the clean art style of Kurt Schaffenberger, but I'll always associate him with Mr. and Mrs. Superman from Superman Family and the New Adventures of Superboy. Mostly Robin looked like himself, except for that one flashback scene where Dick was shown with an S curl. This definitely isn't a complaint, just a random observation. And then our bat cousin from across the ocean, Martin Gray, adds his thoughts. Thanks for another splendid episode. It was fun to hear Brett again. I'm bringing a massive, ugly-looking steak pie to the Barbie this time, as it's a traditional New Year eating here for Scotland. For the vegans, it's roasted vegetables with a garlic and horseradish dip. I miss the Batman Family logo, but I do like this Detective Comics masthead with a swirling cape. Mind, while I love boxed covers, the various styles of lettering here are messy. The most 1970s thing in this issue has to be the Bat Hang Glider, because those pants are classics for all time. If you're wearing something this dashing, you've got possibilities. And that's an audio wink. Then again, look at all that white three-piece suit Christopher Chance wears after staying alive. That's another audio wink. While there should be no unsolved cases of the Batman, I do love to see work by the underrated John Cownan. I got excited. That might be a wink, because there's a Pet Shop Boys song called I Get Excited, but I don't know. That was a B-side, so that wasn't popular, so I don't know if that's what Martin meant. But if you did, Martin, I love you even more than I already do. However, I got excited when you mentioned Justice League of America number 167 as one of the 278 comics of note this month. But checking up, it's 166 that has one of my Answer Man appearances. Dang off months. You can actually buy an omnibus of Star Wars UK original material. I never read it because I'm not a particular fan.
Continuing on Martin's comments, 16 Richie Rich books in the month of March. Maybe that's because it was getting to the end of the financial year, which ends in April, in the UK anyway. Whatever the case, Richie Rich, you're a rich boy and you've gone too far. I got that one, Sean. You know, it doesn't matter anyway, Martin. Regarding the Human Target strip, what is a numbers operation? I've heard of them, but have little idea. Is it the same thing as a numbers game in horse racing? I think it's just illegal gambling, Martin. I think that's what it means. I love Bob Oxner's artwork, top feature, and a great choice on his two most famous covers. A super memorable one for me is action number 454. Remember Superman eating a boatload of burgers? Yeah, I love that one too. That's a great
one. I actually don't need Mike's Amazing World for that one. I have to remember that one.
In the Robin story, I like the idea that the trapeze was pushed towards the Teen Wonder by the ghosts of Dick's parents. That really would be the return of the Flying Graysons. Did he feel it coming in the air tonight? I got that one too. In the letter column, would that be the same Darren Goodhart of Legion of Substitute Podcasters fame? A Goodhart is really hard to find, but by George, I think I've got it. The excellent Darren confirmed on Twitter. Grab him.
So, Martin, if the A Goodhart, if that's the Fogel Sharkey song, A Goodhart these days is hard to find. That was never a hit in America. I'm not blaming you. I'm just saying that's why Paul didn't catch that. If that was your reference, I love that song, but that's why nobody knows that song because it was never a hit here. Sunday nights, probably like back in the 90s, there was a radio show called UK Chart Attack, Sunday nights at like 11 o'clock. And I would stay up and listen and record it like on my cassette player to get all these British songs that never made it here. Bat DJ, Matthew Davis says, am I the only one that saw six stories in this issue and wondered how long the episode of this podcast will be? I already listen at 1.3 times speed. I don't want you guys to sound like Alvin and the Chipmunks. Batman, Wrapped Around Your Finger by the Police. And of course, I know that one. Just a super quick note. So I never cared about the Police, but in high school, I had like this super big crush on someone and he loved the Police. So of course, I got a cassette of the greatest hits of the Police. Now I like them. Boyfriend Band, or I guess a girlfriend band, but it's not alliterative. The music that your partner likes and at first you either don't know or don't care or don't like, and then they listen to it so much that get osmosises into your head.
I never heard that term. Okay. All right. Good to know.
So Batman, the term novel length always seemed weird for a 17 to 18 page story. If the story filled the entire 68 page issue, then yeah. Yeah, Matthew, I agree with that. Villains like Maxi Zeus, who stuck to their themes, probably helped many of us learn about things like Greek mythology. That is absolutely true. And there were a ton of things, The Flash, his science facts.
Oh, yeah.
They definitely helped me in science. We were talking about it in science class. I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that from an issue of The Flash. Matthew Davis's Human Target song is Who Are You by The Who. And I know that one, of course. Nice over-the-shoulder throw on page 2. But I bet he goes through a lot of knives like that. But I'm surprised he didn't utilize his knife throwing skills to stop the shooter in the bucket. That's a fantastic point. Chance's suit on the last page is the most welcome to Fantasy Island thing in this issue. Batgirl, You Dropped a Bomb on Me, Baby, by the Gap Band. This story happening the same night as the lead story is a better explanation than the old Batman is off on a generic JLA mission trope. Babs, should I or shouldn't I run for re-election thing? Sounds like they're setting up for some changes. Robin, My Hometown by Bruce Springsteen. I don't know it at all.
I know that. That's a good one.
Maybe if I heard it, I would know it. Unfortunately for everyone, I cannot, quote unquote, sing it for you.
And I won't.
This story was published early in Dallas's run and about a year before the whole Who Shot JR craze. The girl being named Linda Gray was either a coincidence or the writer was a huge early fan of the show. The Demon, Time After Time by Cyndi Lauper. And I'm sorry to go off again. I love that song. I think it is absolutely beautiful. And so I'm a huge fan of Everything But the Girl. And they do an acoustic folk cover of it. And I'm not saying one is better than the other because they are very different. I would give each of them a 10 because they're fantastic. Maybe it's me, but I've never been a huge fan of Steve Ditko's artwork. It's just one of those personal taste things. That said, I can see his borderline psychedelic style being popular in the 60s. The Unsolved Case song, Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. Of course we know that song. I'm not going to sing it. Galileo, Galileo. Yes, I'm aware of the irony that such a classic song is my earworm for such a bad story. And how is this an unsolved case? Even though what happened to the security guard was a tragic accident, Higley purposefully tried to kill Batman. He wasn't villainous, just scared and desperate and trying not to lose his discovery. As for action versus adventure, I was curious and did some Googling for a difference. Several movie buffs chimed in on Reddit, and a pretty good entry on encyclopedia.com gave a good breakdown. The difference is slim. Action is Indiana Jones running from the boulder or chasing the Nazis on horseback. Adventure is Indiana Jones' search for the Ark of the Covenant. And then Matthew left a link on his website. Check it out.
And then the guest from that very episode, Brett Young, chimed in. Hey, Bat Cousins, thanks for having me on again. I always learn something every time we talk. Like, I didn't know you were both such fans of Identity Crisis.
Oh.
My 7-year-old was very excited to hear his voice on the podcast. Should it bother me that he memorized the incantation of a demon? I'll kick that can down the road. Always great getting together. Glad you liked the Batman Family Reunion shirt. I'm wearing mine right now. Right. And I will again encourage everyone to give Paul and Sean a 5-star review on iTunes. They deserve it. Thank you, Brett. That's very kind. P.S. Not just myself wearing a shirt. I ordered 8 shirts and gave them around to a bunch of my family at Christmas. It was a big hit.
Continuing the debate of action slash adventure, Bat Cousin Brian Linton chimes in. I don't know about movies, but action and adventure are distinct video game genres. For those who don't partake, action games tend to focus on physical challenges that rely on hand-eye coordination and reaction time. For example, fighting games like Mortal Kombat or shooters like Castle Wolfenstein. Adventure games, on the other hand, revolve around exploration and puzzle solving, as in the Myst series of games, and that's a personal favorite of mine. Applying those definitions to the silver screen, I'd consider a movie like Die Hard to be action, as in John McClane runs around killing all the bad guys, while Star Trek IV, The Journey Home, would be adventure, as in the crew has to figure out how to transport two whales through time. The Indiana Jones films have a good mix of both action and adventure. That's my take on the matter anyway. Sorry, this has nothing to do with the comic you discussed, which I really enjoyed, but your offhand comment about action-adventure movies got me thinking. Thanks for another excellent adventure. And if anyone gets off topic, it's me singing songs. So not that you need to be forgiven, Brian, but if you need that, you're forgiven, but you don't need it.
Finally, our bat cousin Mark Baker Wright says, the MacGuffin of the Galileo solution bears more than a passing resemblance to the eponymous universal solvent of the Uncle Scrooge story by Don Rosa. The DC Universe should thank its lucky stars, or at least its writers, that the Galileo version dissipates after it's spilled. In Rosa's version, the solvent ate through anything except diamond, and as such, when Scrooge carelessly poured it straight onto the ground, the solvent began to eat its way to the Earth's core, necessitating a journey to the center of the Earth to prevent the solvent from causing the Earth destruction. Like all of Rose's work, I heartily recommend the story. That is awesome. I will definitely check that out. I actually met Don Rosa at a convention once, and my son is a big fan of his work when he was younger, and I bought a print from him where Uncle Scrooge is substituted for Batman on a homage cover of Detective Number 27, which is hilarious, and it's still hanging in my son's room, who's 26 now.
Now we will acknowledge our Bat Family members who shared our podcast on social media. We appreciate the support from our online community. So we're going to thank Chris Franklin, Tim Pinsonal, Brett Young, Max Romero, Mike Thomas, Terry O'Malley, Bill Bear, Jay Campbell, Doug Game Master, Herschel Mimas, Robert Gross, Jim Owsley, Don Lindbergh, Carol Teague, Alistair James Dunbar, and Clinton Robinson. And we're also going to thank at AskAnnieSon22, that's AskAnnieSon22, Just Trying to Browse, Firestorm Fan, Irredeemable Shag, Dr. Pop Culture, Coffee and Comics, Steve Whitbread, Jim Ball, and Michael Thomas. Thanks a lot for all your internet love. Before we sign off, as most of our listeners know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network has gotten more costly over the years as more and more shows were added. So if you are enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other shows on the network, please consider becoming a patron. We are not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount you can give helps defray the cost. And I promise that any donations that you provide will not go towards building a GoBots mech suit for me so I can finally meet my hero, Man-Bat. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FW podcasts, and thanks.
All right, Bat Cousins, that'll do it for the feedback section and for episode 485. We want to thank again our special guest, Ward Hill Terry, for appearing on this episode. And thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us next month for the return of Alfred.
Yay!